Hello, I'm Scott Guthrie, and welcome to episode 49 of the Influencer Marketing Lab. Welcome back to a brand new season of the Influencer Marketing Lab, and a big thank you once more to Tagger by Sprout Social for the paid partnership. We've got a busy season ahead. I've already recorded the interviews, but before we kick off with today's guest, I want to tell you a little bit about my weekly newsletter, The Creator Briefing. Each Wednesday at noon UK time, I publish a breakdown covering all the major news from the creator marketing industry, alongside my insight and analysis. You can subscribe at www.creatorbriefing.com or check out the show notes for the link. Right then. Back to today's guest. This week, I am in conversation with Sammy Albin, Senior Campaign Director at agency What They Said. In this episode, we discuss what authenticity means from the point of view of both a creator and from a brand's point of view. Why A is for authenticity and affinity, but why A is for all, or will be revealed. We talk about de-influencing, plus the benefits of long-term brand collaborations with creators and how brands can effectively work with creators in their promoted media. Check out the Influencer Marketing Lab for the full show notes, related useful links and a transcript, and don't forget to sign up to Creator Briefing newsletter. The Influencer Marketing Lab has been made possible through a paid sponsorship with Tagger by Sprout Social. Tagger by Sprout Social is a global leader in revolutionizing how top brands and agencies harness data and analytics to drive creator and influencer marketing strategies. Trusted by global enterprises, Tagger is a disruptive SaaS solution that offers unparalleled expertise. Leveraging API partnerships with major social channels, Tagger connects millions of brand and influencer profiles to billions of social data points, offering the industry's most robust social intelligence and actionable insights. Tagger's platform provides powerful analytics, all-in-one capabilities, and strategic integrations for efficient campaign workflows. To learn more, visit www.taggermedia.com. Now on with the show. This week on the show, I am in conversation with Sammy Albin. Sammy is the Senior Campaign Director at What They Said, leading the What They Said activation team in delivering award-winning, less ordinary, more meaningful influencer campaigns. Prior to joining What They Said, Sammy was a senior creative strategist, designing and running global performance campaigns across entertainment, music and gaming. Before shifting agency side, Sammy was a full-time content creator for 8 years alongside his twin brother. Together they ran 3 YouTube channels and multiple Twitter and Instagram accounts. Together they grew an audience of over 500,000 viewers, and Sammy has also co-produced and hosted BBC One's Return to Comedy with Nikki and Sammy Peachy podcast, which ran for 4 seasons, 48 episodes, and featured a range of guests from Steve Aoki to Greg James and even some K-pop idols. Welcome to the show, Sammy.
Thanks, Scott. Can I just point out that you're probably the first person that's ever said my surname correctly first try. It is Albin. Everyone always says Albin. So I'm enamoured. But no, thanks for having me. That was. It's always lovely to hear such great things for feel like a lifetime ago. And the irony of having a comedy podcast where I'm not remotely funny will never be lost on me.
Well, let's dive straight into this. We're old pals here, so I'm not going to try and do a Paxman on you. It's just trying to open up the conversation. I'm not trying to trip you up. But as a creator and a marketer, you're in a rare position to be able to balance the equation and understand both what a creator needs from a brand collab and what a brand is expecting from forging a relationship with a creator. What are the main differences, do you think, in needs, and how can we narrow what expectation gap there is from either side?
I think it's an interesting question because I don't really know if the needs are any different to one another. I mean, ultimately, the reason an influencer is taking part in a branded partnership is kind of twofold. they want to monetize their content. That's why I did it, as well as potentially reach, you know, new audiences that you can't typically reach, or have experiences that add value to your audience. And as a creator, my driving force was, how do I give value to my audience? Because ultimately, what's more important to me is my audience that I've built over years, not that one-off partnership. So it's really trying to craft something authentic. And I know we'll talk about the A word loads, I imagine, throughout this, the A word being authentic, of course, and authenticity. But for brands, I think they're very aligned. They want to reach engaged audiences that actually care really deeply about what their favorite influencer is doing, saying, talking about, and advocating for. So I guess both of them are really after the same thing, authentic partnerships that feel really native to their platforms. Sorry, I can keep talking about this at length. I think that there really isn't a difference between what the two want from the partnership.
Well, let's tease apart some of the things that you've just said. Mm. So you've talked about authenticity, but I think a brand wants its brand messages to be kind of smuggled through to an audience.
Yes.
What the two in common have got is an audience or a community. The brand, I would imagine, wants all these messages to be passed through to that community. And the creator wants to, if not sanitize, then at least that translate those messages into something that's palatable and relatable to their community.
Mm.
So it's kind of a translation job, I'm guessing. And you might say, at one end of the spectrum, it might be the brand saying, read out this script. And at the other end, it's saying, you know, trust me, I know what my audience wants. Let's co-create this together. And then they meet somewhere in the middle. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that similar to your thoughts?
A lot of this comes down to, I think you touched on it there, the affinity between the brand and the influencer, which has a knock-on effect with authenticity and what success looks like for the partnership. And I think ultimately, from the influencer side, we'll get onto Instagram and TikTok and how that kind of democratized influence. But traditionally, influencers were typically quite choosy about the brands they partner with because they really needed to align. They needed to find a brand that they were already fans of, or felt like it was a seamless addition to their content, have spoken about before, or offered something that would be really beneficial to their audience. So I think then likewise, that makes it easier for the brand to impart a deeper understanding of their product or service, or include that key messaging in a really authentic, credible way. So a lot of it is, I think you've seen, particularly over lockdown and how influencer marketing has scaled, there's a real focus on churn and earn models of like, let's do scaled influencer campaigns across the board, across the, you know, gaming apps and all sorts, which doesn't really speak to the magic of influencer, which is authentic endorsements. And you've seen, I'm getting carried away here, Scott, but you've seen the rise of de-influencing. I'd argue that's just taken us back to where influencer has always been.
Keep your powder dry on de-influencing, because we're going to open up later in the chat. But whilst I've got you on a rant, let's try and harness that rant.
Reel me in, because I'll carry on. So
just trying to focus it towards authenticity. We've used the word a few times. You've called it the A word. We've spoken over the years about authenticity and what it means. It's obviously a bedrock tenet of influencer marketing. But what does it mean to you? How would you define it?
I'll look at this from an influencer perspective and then, I guess, from a branded partnerships perspective. But for me, when I was a creator, authenticity was being true to the person that I was portraying myself to be online. I don't feel like I swayed too much from that. But obviously, there's an idealized version of yourself. So that, you know, I was great online. So it was also understanding that my audience, what they wanted, and I knew really intimately what they loved, liked and hated, what got them up in the morning, what got them excited, and the brands that they loved, as well as the brands that they would have hated to see me align myself with. There was one instance where I was approached by a chocolate brand that I guess kind of positions itself as the world's leading nutrition, health and wellness company. I did that from their website. But they wanted to pay quite a generous fee to create my face in chocolate. I mean, what an unappealing thought, or a terrifying concept, and then I give that way to viewers, which again, can't think of anything more unappetizing. But I turned it down on multiple reasons. And I think this was kind of in about 2014, 2015, where that money could have made a real difference to me. But I turned it down predominantly because of my personal values when it comes to sort of sustainability. I think they produce a lot of plastic bottles, and as well as to be seen to be endorsing a company that has quite questionable labour and manufacturing policies. And back then, that's I guess 2014, 2015, the attitude for audiences now when they see a branded partnership is, yeah, get that bag, get that coin. Back then it was, oh, that's really heavily scrutinized this branded partnership. So from an influencer perspective, I never wanted to step foul of my audience. From a brand's perspective, I guess authenticity is how do we seamlessly weave our key messaging so we can hit our KPIs in content that works, that is successful, that feels like a seamless ad to the influencer. And I think brands can really fall short and do dirty with authenticity when they don't appreciate that influencers really do understand their audiences so intimately. And this whole industry is just built on relationships between viewers that really trust their favorite creators. So it is a balancing act. And I guess the agency's role in that, if done properly, is a facilitator of those partnerships that safeguards the influencers' tone of voice and type of content they typically create, and then also helps the brand go on the journey with them and shows them how they're going to implement call to actions and campaign key messaging within the content in a really effective way.
We said at the top that the A word was authenticity, but it also could work as affinity here. You're talking about sharing values, sharing beliefs, a worldview from the individual, from the creator's point of view, but also from the brand's point of view. And that is, you know, when they are true to themselves, you get that authentic content.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the role the agency should play, if this is the role they fulfill in the partnership process, is we've seen, obviously, data-driven influencer selection is, you know, it's not a USP. A very minimum brand should know that their content is at least reaching the target demographic. Yeah. But it takes, I think you've seen the rise of AI, which is terrifying. We'll be out of jobs, probably. But it really takes a human touch to find influencers that align on multiple different levels. So do they look and sound and speak and live like your target consumer? Are they going to be able to educate on a particularly difficult topic? Is it a financial service brand that we need to take some sensitivity around? You know, is it gambling? Is it has its own challenges? Is it high fat, sugar and salt? It takes a human touch to really find the right influencers. And it shouldn't just be, oh, they've got a 70% UK audience with 18 to 24 year olds. That's not enough. So it is finding influencers that have that very clear affinity. Perhaps they've mentioned Cadbury 4 or 5 times in the most recent content. And because the agency has done a great social listening job, they've picked that up and they've found, you know, like a rising star that is a perfect partner for Cadbury. It's going a little bit further than just putting names on paper. And it's building out those relationships and focusing on longer term offerings.
So the selection process may start with the data and... But it ends with the human contextual intelligence of the practitioner. I think 5 or 6 years ago, there was not enough data. Now I think sort of there's this deification of data, and we need to marry the two.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we're in a moment where it's death by data, and obviously we all love an insight. But I think the influencer space doesn't go far enough sometimes. So what they said is part of the Pretty Green Group, we've set up a D&I framework called the A's for All framework. So any influencer shortlist that we piece together based on the data and aligning, you know, demographic data and tone of voice and types of content, we go one step further because we feel that any campaign should be representative. It's not a box ticking exercise. We want the beauty of influencers that these people aren't seen on TV. These are unique voices, faces, people that traditional media could only hope to include. So the A's for All framework is focused on how do we make sure that this is representative of age, gender, ability, sexuality. Age as well is often omitted.
Yeah.
And I think it's our driving force from a position of privilege is to uplift influencers that perhaps don't have the opportunity that many sort of cis, white, straight creators would have had. And that's really eye-opening. It's something that we've really focused on in the past year. And it's really fulfilling. It's nice to see it in practice and seeing that in content strategies too.
Well, it's the right thing to do, and so it makes you feel warm inside. But it's not purely altruism, because the wider you spread the net, the more representative the creators are of the audience or the community that you're trying to influence.
Yeah, definitely.
Scrolling back to authenticity, I read a chapter for an early influencer marketing textbook published by Routledge, the influencer marketing, building brand, communities and engagement, if you want to rush out and buy it. I mention it because authenticity was mentioned 212 times throughout the book. So it is, you know, obviously it's a bedrock, returning to what we said at the top, it's a bedrock tenet of our industry. But in academia, interesting. Well, I'll say it, you decide whether it's interesting or not. But in academia, they distinguish between passionate authenticity and transparent authenticity. So we've talked a lot in this conversation about passionate authenticity that emerges when influencers are driven by their inner desires, their passions, more than by a commercial goals. And you said, you, as a creator, you turned down the offer of big dollar signs and chocolate effigies because it didn't chime with your worldviews. That is passionate authenticity. Transparent authenticity, they say, refers to the influencer's ability to provide fact-based information about the product or the service at the center of the brand partnership. So it's an interesting sort of teasing apart, similar, but not the same. Mm.
I think it'd be interesting to see how things change as well. I mean, you know better than most, Scott. Firstly, I want a signed copy of the book, please, so I can say I have one. But secondly, I think we've seen TikTok has just transformed things since, well, obviously the onset of lockdown. It was a real heyday moment for it, and it's still going. But what it did do is suddenly democratize influence. Anyone could become an influencer. And you know, I spent years trying to get an audience over 200,000 on YouTube, and that was a real chore. But suddenly you're seeing people get millions, if not tens of millions of views overnight on a particular piece of content, and then perhaps not seeing that again. But what it did do is lower the barrier of entry. And then, unlike YouTube, which is the reason I mentioned it, there is no, obviously there's a creator awards program, and they offer like monetary benefits to influencers when they reach certain criteria, etc. But there's no ad share. So what that means is that influencers can have millions of viewers, but they're not getting ad revenue like YouTube would provide. So they're far less selective about the branded work that they do. So I think it's changing the landscape, and it's not a problem specific to TikTok, which is why you see such a heavy focus on paid media on TikTok, obviously to get the views when the algorithm doesn't treat the content particularly well. But then on Instagram as well, obviously there's less opportunity to earn revenue natively on the platform. The space is so nuanced now because you've got YouTube creators who are earning AdSense that don't need to take every single piece of branded work. And this is why we're seeing the onset. I've said I'm about to go into de-influencing, so I'm going to stop myself. But this is why we're seeing this revival of a trend that actually was commonplace. So I wonder how this authenticity will change over the coming years.
That's a neat segue. But before we dive in...
I'm desperate to get there, Scott.
I'm holding hard on these reins. You're a fool to yourself it's only because you said such interesting things a moment ago that I want to try and delve into that before we move on to de-influencing. Influencers or content creators are one time being beholden upon either AdSense on YouTube, and if you said that's not the same on other platforms, or they're beholden to brands for collaborations. And I think increasingly we're seeing lots of other potential revenue streams for creators. Creators are not so beholden on brand collaborations. Hopefully that means that they can pick and choose. Right, that rant over. Let's dive into your favourite question that you've been chomping at the bit to get into. This year, we've seen de-influencing blow up as a thing. It was called de-hauling on YouTube 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, but now on TikTok specifically, it's called de-influencing. Is the trend helpful, or is it a hindrance to influencer marketing?
Okay, so de-influencing, I'll say, I'm a little over hearing brands and agents talk about it as if it's the newest thing. And you rightly said, Scott, like it's been this common trend of advocating really for products you do believe in and saying poo-poo to the ones that you don't was commonplace on YouTube. Longer form content, I guess people are far more invested in what people actually think. In my mind, and I know I echo Natalia from Good Egg, because I saw some content you put on LinkedIn around this, I guess all influencers originally did de-influence. They actively spoke about the things they really loved or those they disliked. But for the sake of, I sound old when I say this, but I guess Gen Z are too young to remember that and are sort of coming into seeing influencers well past this phase of talking about these sort of things. So essentially we moved away from that when the new platforms emerged. And like I said, obviously it then democratized influencers. Suddenly more people were creators. Obviously, platforms like TikTok and Instagram and Facebook to a degree, because they don't support these influencers in other ways. We just saw a deluge of like branded partnerships on TikTok. So I guess authenticity took a real hit and then came under the microscope, if you will, far more for brands. And then obviously with the emergence of TikTok, more brands are seeing it as a way to market to different audiences and want to get involved in influencer. And it was cost effective. Obviously, TikTok's a lot cheaper, was a lot cheaper to activate on. So we saw a greater volume of branded partnerships. And I guess that's where authenticity suddenly became questioned. And multiple partnerships from one influencer, as soon as the exclusivity period ended on their contract, became the norm. My view is that de-influencing has always been around. It's not a bad thing. And if anything, it's a moment for brands to sit back and think, okay, how do we find these long-term ambassadors, these people that can advocate for us on socials, also behind closed doors and behind the scenes in closed channels, because they actually love what we do and we've built a meaningful relationship together. So to answer your question, I think de-influencing isn't new. It's a good thing. We are starting to see more authentic endorsements again, because I think authenticity did get pulled into question quite a lot since sort of 2018 with the rise of more people creating branded content.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that rise of, you said, you market the sort of the high water tide of, is that Instagram aesthetic, wasn't it? And people rushing into the space. I think, and again, the academics would call that role conflict. That role conflict crept into the equation. As consumers, we wanted the influencers we followed to be authentic and knowledgeable. We wanted them to be honest and unbiased. And this sometimes came into conflict with the sponsoring brands. We've touched this on the opening question. The brands wanted the influencers they work with to say nice things about their products. And as role conflict increased, so did our wariness of influencers' sincerity and their trustworthiness.
Yeah.
And I think it's this erosion of trust pushed some influencers to re-examine their role and to prioritize or reprioritize subject matter expertise and trustworthiness and credibility above their role of product seller. And as we've just touched on as well, there are more avenues to create revenue as creators now. Happily, progressive influencer marketers identified and selected influencers to work with based on at least as much about the creator's credibility and values and beliefs, everything we said in question one, as they did about follower count and engagement rates and those sorts of things. I think it's a positive thing. It allows the industry to recalibrate and to really go back to, again, the A word of authenticity.
Yeah. I think as well, you're far more eloquent than I when you speak about it. But I think we're seeing, obviously, influencers. There's the debate again, do we call them creators? I think it'll be a timeless argument. Obviously, now we've got key opinion leaders entering the fray. Yeah. And I think, I guess, to be a key opinion leader, can you really endorse, say you're in the haircare field, you can't really go from endorsing one hair care brand to another in the next month, particularly maybe if you're focusing on male hair loss or chiropractic. Yeah, like, can you? I think it comes back to what is the narrative of the content? What is this influencer trying to achieve? So yeah, as audiences get more niche as well, and say they're, I was about to go into true crime, but gamers, for instance, I guess they need to have a clear affinity with one leading brand or product because it gives them credibility in the space as well. So it's definitely beneficial to both the brand and the influencers.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to go off on a tangent. I think I will go off on a tangent.
Do it. I'm here for it.
About nomenclature. And you mentioned influencers, and that's increasingly a pejorative term. I think it's the category owner, and I've said that before. So when we're wrapping up presents, we turn to the sellotape, even though we probably just use some stuff from, from Poundland. You know, we hoover the floor rather than vacuum it. We don't get in the hot tub, you go in the jacuzzi. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the category owner. But I think it's also about the shifting sands as well. We've moved from influencer to creator. It also depends on what platform there was. Like you as a YouTuber probably thought of yourself always as a creator, whether it's Instagram, you might have been an influencer. You mentioned KOLs or key opinion leaders. That was always an Asian thing. But they also have internet celebrities, which I think are called Weihang in China. So they're different names, slightly different elements and different platforms. It might also be gender specific. Specific or hint towards a gender bias. Females are more influencer, and then the last bit. I'm increasingly hearing that influencers don't want to be called influencers or creators. Content creators is even problematic because sex workers used to call themselves content creators, so they could get past the algorithms.
Mm.
And now increasingly, we've moved from influencer to creator to content creator. Creators are founders rather than other things because of these different revenue streams.
Well, who knows where it'll go next? I just know that when I was a creator, I actually hated the term influencer because I thought it denoted a sense of like hubris. Who am I to assume that I am influencing anyone? I'm just making silly videos that I'm uploading to the internet, to the YouTube, I nearly said, to the internet 3 times a week and growing an audience. And I think also mainstream media, rightly or wrongly, kind of classes or kind of typifies influencer in quotes with sort of ex-Love Islanders or people that have stumbled into influencing. So people that haven't grown communities. So I think most of the people on the ASA hit list or the blacklist or the wall of shame, as it's called, tend to be ex-reality TV stars.
There's lots there that I want to come back on. So first of all, I love that differentiator between influencer and creator, because you're right. Creation is an output. Mm. Influence is an outcome, isn't it?
And very true.
And how can I say that I'm an influencer because all I'm trying to do is, it's like calling yourself the world's sexiest lover. Someone else has to say, you're the world's greatest lover. You can't go around calling yourself it. It's not in your gift. And I think that there's an element of that with calling yourself an influencer. You're a creator. Mm-hmm. You hope to influence, but you're beholden on a community to do that. And that was another word that you used, a community. Mm. I think in mainstream media there has been a conflation over the years between lumping everybody into one bucket and calling them influencers when they mean
it's easier.
And to go back to that word community, and I think you're right, it is a creator is someone that is born on social and has spent their time honing their craft and building a community, whereas someone like an ex-reality TV star has grown overnight success, if you like, on Instagram. That's why understandably they make mistakes, because their heels aren't held to the fire by a community saying, I wouldn't do that brand collab because it doesn't really chime with your values. They know that they've got probably 6 months in the sun to sell anything to anyone. And so they're not shackled by ethics.
Yeah.
That's why I think there's been this conflation, certainly in the mainstream media that we've talked about. I think ending up on de-influence, I think it's worth mentioning that de-influencing isn't the opposite of influencing.
Yeah, definitely.
If anything, it's highlighting that the power of influencing, isn't it? De-influencing would be to show a powerlessness and a weakness. The hashtag de-influencing, for example, has been viewed, I don't know, 200 million times this year alone. So to say that it's the anti-influencing just seems an anathema.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's also quite heartening, because actually influencers are showing the brands that perhaps maybe don't pay fairly or don't respect their time or value, that actually, no, the power is still very much in their hands, and these communities love and invest in them. So let's build something slightly more long term. And I just think I'd like to see more of it. And I think we should be feeling, as viewers as well, as people consuming the content, we want to make sure that the people we're investing in are also really sharing their actual endorsements, and not just someone they're being paid slightly more to follow up with.
I agree wholeheartedly. The Influencer Marketing Lab has been made possible through a paid sponsorship with Tagger by Sprout Social. Tagger's discovery tool lets you apply hundreds of different filters to their huge database so you can find exactly the influencers you want that perfectly match your campaign. I've seen agencies and brands discover high-value influencers in less than a quarter of an hour. Tagger's affinity tool takes discovery a step further by showing you an influencer's brand affinity. It means you're able to partner with influencers who are most likely to enjoy your brand or product. It helps you find audiences who already have an affinity with you. Tagger by Sprout Social focuses on their customers' success. When you sign up to their platform, you're given a dedicated customer success manager. They guide you through everything, from onboarding to training to just checking in and making sure you're finding success with the platform. When you're running an influencer campaign, sometimes it can be difficult to measure your success, but it's easy to report your campaign data with Tagger by Sprout Social. Their modular report builder lets you pull accurate, real-time data directly from social media platforms. You can choose which metrics matter most to you and to your clients, meaning you can customize the data that you show in every report. Something that can be overlooked when you're choosing an influencer marketing platform is the quality of the data. Tagger has direct API access to all major social media platforms. This gives Tagger users access to 100% accurate, real-time data that's gathered responsibly. You can't plan a good strategy if you're not looking at quality data. And if you're looking to scale your influencer marketing efforts, Tagger by Sprout Social is a truly global solution. Its availability in more than 10 languages and the ability to make multi-currency payments directly on platform gives brands a huge advantage when running multinational or multilingual influencer campaigns. If you want to see how Tagger by Sprout Social can work for you, go to taggermedia.com/request-demo. Let's shift on now and talk about long-term relationships. I think the quest for forging long-term relationships between a brand and creator is not new. I've been banging on about it since at least 2016, and I suspect you've been doing similar. But why are we still talking about it? What's in it for brands and creators?
I mean, I think I was actually on a panel in probably about 2016 in London. We was talking about this. There's a bunch of brands, and the agencies that I was on the stage with were saying, oh, all we do is long-term partnerships. And I was gobsmacked, because mostly my friendship circle were influencers. They didn't exist, and they often still don't exist, these long-term partnerships. So I had to call them out, and I said, no, you're not doing long-term partnerships. And I know for a fact you're not doing long-term partnerships. I think there's a real sense that influencer is still new. I mean, it isn't. But when brands approach it, there is obviously often a lot of inertia or internal convincing that influencer is the right way to go. So from my perspective, it's really refreshing, because all I seem to do with what they said is sort of long-term annual or quarterly partnerships that are built out over, you know, multiple touch points. We're not just doing a flash in the pan here. We're testing and refining strategies with the same influencers based on like agreed KPI frameworks. So these aren't just also us throwing names into the mix. These are deeply rationalized influencer selections that are based on all the things that I've said about previously. But there's also, like, for brands, and I think they don't see this, there's huge commercial benefit as well for long-term partnerships. And I guess you could break it down into like four or five key points. And I don't want to bore you, Scott, but I could easily go into it.
Don't worry, I'll edit the boring bits out later. Hit me with it.
Well, obviously it saves time and money. So partnering with influencers for a longer period of time, they're more likely to, you know, there's financial security for them in that. And we have to remember that not every influencer, and actually more influencers than not, it's a happy accident that they've got this audience. They've generated it, and they aren't perhaps as business savvy. So locking them into longer term partnerships is really reassuring for them, and it helps them understand that you appreciate their input and their value as well. So it saves time in terms of having to rebrief them. It saves money, because they're likely to offer you a good deal. It helps them build trust with you and the brand. And also audiences trust their endorsement, because there's multiple touch points. My favorite part about long-term partnerships is the experimentation that it affords. So you can test new formats. So for us, obviously, YouTube Shorts is a huge opportunity at the moment. So working with YouTube creators on a cross-platform strategy, and then suddenly saying, okay, actually, this key campaign beat will really resonate on Shorts. So why don't we allocate 5-10% of the quarterly budget to test new platforms for the client, and or, you know, more formats for paid. And also, and now ultimately, it does allow you to combat de-influencing, because you've got someone that's bought into the brand, has a deep understanding of the campaign and their role in it and what you're trying to achieve, and they're invested in it. So they want to keep working with you, work to the same end. And you often get a lot of additional value, added value content from influencers because they feel like they're working to the same goal. You're essentially fighting against the influencing. It's measurement. So actually, it is relevant to this, but it's around measurement. So I don't know if you've got any other points you want to go over for.
When I was thinking about this earlier, I was thinking a difference between effectiveness and efficiency here. You've combined the two nicely. Yes, it saves time and money because a lot of influencer marketing, or at least the workflow, is front-ended in terms of identification and selection and recruitment. We've talked about earlier in the conversation. And that takes expertise and also takes access to tools, and that's expensive. And one agency I was talking with estimates that they save 40% of billable hours by working with the same influencer on a long-term basis. 40%. And that doesn't mean that they trouser the money. That means they put it into more creative content and more strategic work. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. The longer a brand and a creator works together, the deeper the understanding of each other, and then the more interesting the content comes out of that. I think you're more able to jump from trend to trend. If you see a micro trend erupting on TikTok, you're able to jump on that rather than trying to go out and do the identification, selection and recruitment process by which time you've missed the trend. I think also you've mentioned about being cheaper pro rata, and also it works on both sides to be able to sort of ring fence, you know, where your budget is being spent and out of real. It can also block out competition. If you've locked in the biggest or the most interesting influencer in your space, that also obviously means that your competitor can't work with him. There's that as well. I think also in terms of, you know, jumping on micro trends, we haven't seen it much, but I think we will increasingly see it in terms of crisis communication.
Oh, 100%.
If you're already working with an influencer, with a creator, and you have a long-term relationship and you trust each other, if something goes wrong at the brand or at the firm, a creator can humanize the problem and explain to the community what the brand is doing to rectify it. This is what they're doing. This is how long it's going to take. Yes, there's been a mistake. This is how they're going to sort it out. So that's a lot of efficiencies. But one more thing on effectiveness is the impact on memory, encoding and recall from seeing the same piece of content with the same creators over the long period. And maybe that's what you're going to talk about.
It's like you've seen my notes, Scott.
We're so in tune.
We're so in sync. But I think you're totally right. And I think we could probably argue about the origin of influencer marketing, but I reckon, and has an educated guess, that it was probably born out of PR more so than any sort of media agencies, etc. So if you think back to where that began, advocacy for longer periods of time was the norm. So it's like we forgot that and we moved away from it. And now we're trying to rediscover that because actually it works. You're right, proving the efficiency, improving beyond, vanity metrics. Yes, we've got 1,000 clicks on this link or the 10,000 views. Measuring the impact is difficult. And you know this as much as everyone else, that one of the biggest problems facing influencers is that proving ROI is seen to be impossible, which is just obviously incorrect. But so for us, I think probably about 3 out of 4 of our campaigns do tend to be longer term ambassador programs. What they said, we have an insights and planning team. It's called Studio, that sort of underpins all that we do in terms of that strategic planning and measurability, etc. So from anecdotally, I know that multiple touch points from influencer content is really valuable. But how do we quantify that? So obviously you start beginning to look at social listening, but then more specifically brand uplift studies. And I have anonymized some data here, but I found it super interesting. I wanted to share what we'd seen. This is a sort of amalgamation of across different campaigns. But you touched on essentially brand recall and spontaneous awareness. And for some of the campaigns, we'd seen a huge change. So for those that aren't aware, and again, like you said earlier, teach anyone to suck eggs, but a brand uplift study is measured against before the onset of campaign activities, that takes a sample group of, so you've already aligned who your influencers are. So you're either you rate internally or you're part of a brand uplift agency to take a sample of the audience of the influencers that you're going to partner with throughout the next 6 to 12 months, 18 months, etc. And they'll run a series of questions against them. And then you measure any sort of wave against that sample group. And we saw huge upticks in sort of top of mind spontaneous awareness, which is obviously recognition and recall as a direct result of influencer content, was huge, sometimes between 10 and 20% higher. When you look at brand consideration, that could increase by up to 20 to 40% sometimes, which is obviously driving stronger brand relevance amongst influencers' audiences. Some of the greatest uplift we've often seen is consideration and brand love amongst, which obviously everyone's targeting, Gen Z and niche audiences. So those that are maybe slightly more marginalized than typical audiences. And we saw huge uplift in that. So our challenge is always taking measurability further and really proving the value of influence, because a lot of my friends are still influencers. I want them to get paid well for the work that they do and the audiences they have. But brands need to see, increasingly more so as they're scrutinized for budgets, how is this actually affecting business objectives and how is it driving them? So I've loved being part of this journey, just seeing how we're running brand uplift and how that is actually impacting the campaign and what audiences are thinking and feeling off the back of content, not just actions they're taking.
I love that. That's a really strong, an important element of it. Stronger positive emotion, top of mind awareness.
Mm.
As exposure to ambassador content increases over time, I think we become more invested in the creator's journey with that brand. I think we're less likely to feel bored, and we're more likely to feel a stronger connection. And ultimately, from a brand point of view, I think whilst the long-term payoff is intent to purchase increases as followers become more invested in that long-term journey.
One of the key metrics as well is studying sort of post-campaign exposure action. So what are audiences doing after having seen or listened to or watched campaign content? And I think one of the campaigns we saw, over half of them were willing to take an action, like click a link, and a quarter of them would have considered getting the product or service, or at least taking a further visit to a site, which is huge, because often I think, particularly on any performance focused campaigns, you could argue between 40 and 50% of conversions are untrackable, because we know that people will watch content and they'll make a decision at a later date and then you can't find it, or the only way to really track it is sort of assisted conversions through Google Analytics data. So you lose half the journey. So I've just loved seeing, putting this down, just seeing exactly what audiences are feeling after content and how it does work.
It's moving away from the vanity metrics towards the intent metrics and ultimately the impact metrics. That's so powerful. Sammy, we got one more real question now, and then after that we'll sort of go into the final furlong. Let's talk a little bit about promoted media, balancing paid and organic. How can brands effectively use or work with, not use, work with influencers in their promoted media?
Obviously, this is increased massively over the past couple of years. What with TikTok, obviously, there's so many, sparking content is so easy, it's so straightforward, it's effective. Slightly more difficult on YouTube, but still accessible. Don't get me started on Facebook Ad Manager. I'd rather never go near it ever again. It's super confusing. There's kind of two ways that brands can work with influencers with paid, but often I think brands get it wrong. It's my firm belief that paid should only ever complement organic. And obviously I've seen a huge number of agencies offering really competitive blended CPMs when they're talking to brands and prospect clients, saying, oh, we can get you a billion impressions for a pound, and super low, not quite that low, but super competitive CPMs. But you end up in a sticky situation, because what you haven't done is prioritized the storytelling and the content and the creative. What we typically say at the Less All Me Group is that creatively awarded campaigns drive, I think, between 11 and 12 times more market share than those that aren't. So how are you capturing the creative of the content and the storytelling? Because if you go down the route of prioritizing paid, you often abandon that. You often end up with just content that is there, that's quite functional and perhaps is lackluster compared to some really cool content that you've procured the usage rights for after the fact, and then you're amplifying in a really effective way. So I would prefer to see paid complementing a really effective, cool, creative, organic strategy where influencers are doing, we're trusting them to be creative. They are inherently creative, so let's use that. And come up with content that really sings about the product in a really cool way, or service, or whatever the campaign is. And then look at how we can repurpose that for paid, or there is a separate paid brief. Because I think more often than not, brands come unstuck when they're focusing too much on sparking or boosting content. Obviously, we know the algorithm is relentless, so we've got to do what we can. But making paid for assets, there is an art to it too. It's really balancing the creator's tone of voice. I've said this again, but balancing what the creator does so well with what the brand is trying to deliver, as opposed to being super prescriptive and not allowing the freedom to move.
Yeah, I love that. Now, Sammy, we're in the final straight. Hang tough. I'm going to ask you, which I ask all of my guests, how do you keep up to date with all of the changes in our sector? What are your go-to sources?
I just look at your LinkedIn, Scott. That is the... Just kidding. No, I generally, LinkedIn is my go-to. I find it so digestible. We're all strapped for time, right? So unless you're sitting and watching your favorite influencers, I find LinkedIn so useful. I try to post on there as often as I can, but since December, I really haven't posted on there as much as I should.
You're part of the LinkedIn creator cohort, yes, weren't you? Yeah. So, and you weren't just posting, well, you were doing posts, but you were doing videos. So that took a lot of brain power, but also production power, I'd imagine.
Yeah, me and my iPhone. But yeah, it was a lot of editing. But that was a great experience. But, one of the reasons I left being an influencer is I couldn't keep up with the relentless algorithms. And I felt myself doing it again. So I was like, well, let's take a step back. I also have lucky to have quite a few of my friends are still hashtag influencers. So getting the news straight from them as well about what the platform changes are, or the amount of times where they've had advanced access to a platform change before anyone else. I'm like, what's coming? And they can share. Yeah, it's really useful.
Brilliant.
So that's LinkedIn and influencer friends. So I recommend people get some.
Brilliant. Sammy, where can listeners turn to for more information about you and about what they
said? WhatTheySaid.co is the website, and we're always posting on LinkedIn, and there's a lot in the works in terms of podcasts. We'll have to get you on there, Scott. We can collaborate.
Count me in.
And we have our own newsletter as well, which people can sign up to, which offers sort of fortnightly insights around trending sounds, themes, trends on each key platform. And then my LinkedIn, I'm trying to think, this is something I've forgotten, there definitely is. And we've got some upcoming webinar activity as well that will be posted on the website, and for anyone that signs up to the newsletter.
Well, I'll be sure to include those links in the show notes accompanying this podcast episode. Just Google the Influencer Marketing Lab for further details. Sammy Allman, Senior Campaign Director at What They Said, thank you so much for your time and for all your insights today.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Influencer Marketing Lab with me, Scott Guthrie. My podcast is in a paid sponsorship with Tagger by Sprout Social. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you enjoy listening to podcasts. And for more information, visit influencermarketinglab.com. Sign up to the weekly newsletter at www.creatorbriefing.com. And if you want to see how Tagger by Sprout Social can work for you, go to taggermedia.com/request-demo.